Welcome to the 2023 series of the Property Report podcast by Property Guru. This year, we will be exploring the latest trends surrounding the real estate industry across different markets in Asia. Now, for our first episode this year, we will have a chat about the emergence of sustainable architecture that is currently shaping the region. Now, joining us today to share their insights are our highly respected judges of the Property Guru Asia Property Awards series covering different markets. Let us start with Ms. Kristen Thornstein, Head of Partnership Growth for APAC IWG PLC and Chairperson of Singapore. We also have Mr. Louis Violanti, Regional Manager, Western Australia, Inhabit Group, and Chairperson of Australia. And of course, we have Mr. Tian Duong, General Director, Group GSA, Vietnam, and Chairperson of Vietnam. Hello, and great seeing all of you. For our first question, can you describe some of the key principles of sustainable architecture and how they are being applied in your markets?
Why don't we start with Louis?
Okay, thank you. Louis will go first. Thank you. I think in Australia, we're sort of lucky in the sense that our building codes actually force us to put a sustainability into our buildings. And each time there's a new building code comes out, it actually increases the efficiency and sustainability of buildings. But what we're seeing, and that means Green Star and energy efficiency and what we do in facades is a performance space of the skins. But what we're also noticing now is there is a push for carbon neutral buildings, carbon sequestration in buildings, and also trying to get a biophilic design in buildings. So we're moving even ahead of where the codes are asking us to do. So that's where we are in Australia.
Kristen?
Yes, yeah, I will go now. So just like Louis mentioned, sustainable architecture encompasses a range of principles that are aimed at reducing energy consumption, carbon emissions, and waste in construction, operation, and maintenance. So it's a whole range of items that not only relate to the construction itself, such as, you know, energy efficiency and carbon neutrality. It's all also relative to the operation of the building. Is renewable energy integrated in it? Do we preserve water? And then it also relates to the position of the building in the built environment. Is it well connected to public transport so that people don't need to take the car? Is there integration of biophilic elements and elements that enhance people's well-being while they're in the building? So in Singapore, we have the Green Mark rating system, which is highly used by developers in assessing the sustainability of a building. But different regions have different criteria. We're seeing that a lot of push is coming from Europe, whereby investment funds will no longer be able to invest in buildings if they're not rated. And I think we're just going to see that more and more in our region as well.
Well, actually, coming from Vietnam, it's very different. You know, the government is not pushing sustainability at the moment. So the regulations, there's nothing there. So, but there's an advantage where architects and developers have to be a little bit more creative. You know, costs here are less than Australia and Singapore. So architects apply more of a sustainable type of passive design to bring sustainability into projects. For example, you know, in Vietnam, the west is very hot, you know, so they try to orient the buildings so that the views and you know, is towards the north or the south or even east. And other things like bamboo is being used because it's a renewable kind of source of materials which is readily available in Vietnam. The one thing that Vietnam cannot do is, you know, many of the imported mechanical systems, which is very important in Australia and in Singapore to reduce energy efficiency, and it does not get is not efficient in Vietnam because the cost is so expensive. you know, so it kind of for developers, it doesn't make a lot of sense to spend all that money to reduce electricity or consumption of energy.
Thank you so much. For the second question, how have architects and developers in your respective markets responded to the growing demand for sustainable buildings in recent years?
Kirsten, you go first.
I'll go first on this one. So in Singapore, we are blessed with many developers who are embracing sustainability. And I want to call out Guoco Land and UOL, who have been at the forefront in achieving high sustainability ratings. Guoco Midtown development in Singapore has received the Green Mark Platinum Award, which is the highest possible rating in the Singapore system. It has integrated extensive landscape in a very high green plot ratio. And then there are various measures to reduce water use less electricity that are within the building. When it comes to UOL, actually all of their residential developments have passive sustainable features. Jian mentioned, the orientation of the building is critical, because if you have a large west-facing facade, your apartment is an oven. UOL also employs a lot of natural cross ventilation, sun fading, and I think across the board in Singapore, developers really make use of the use of landscaping and integrating green elements and foliage into the developments.
Louis?
Yes, that's great. And I think we do here, and the developers actually pride themselves on actually putting sustainability into the designs, and architects are fully versed and really a cohesive to do that as well. There's a conscious effort there. And I was about to say, the building which won the award last year for sustainability was a building in Melbourne. And what they created there for the DARE group, the Zero Gips building. And what they did there was actually create a building with open spaces, green, recycled building forms. So what they created is, what I'm trying to say is, a space where to live and to work in that space was a space like your home. So you felt like you could ride your bikes. There was end-of-trip facilities, so it was near public transport, so you didn't have to drive. Very inner city, congested areas. So they tried to create this oasis. When you did come to work, you felt like a building which was tactile, had passive breezes come through the building. You could feel like you were almost in like a large home. So that was one example which won and got plaudits from all of us and the judges panel. So, and that's just one. I mean, I just went to a building site last week in Perth, where it's the largest timber frame building in Western Australia. And I just walked through the building, and the floors, the structure, the roof, everything is built out of timber. All the fixtures and fittings were timber, but had modern technologies of curtain walls on the outside. But once you're in the building space, as a university building, you actually felt like it was so conducive to learning and being in that space. So it actually promotes education or promotes healthy living in those spaces. So that's what I think is the next phase of what we're doing. It's actually trying to provide environments which are better to live in, better to learn in, and better for the patrons of the building. So that's something we see all the time. And the other thing about Australia is, maybe Singapore is quite a small city state, and Vietnam's a moderate sized country, but we have weather extremes in our country. We have very humid to the top of our country, and then we have very cold weather to the southeast. And in the west, we have quite temperate climates. So the architects learn how to design in those environments as well. So we're very, very conscious in the West, because we're a warmer climate with breezes, that we use those breezes in the design, and the architects do that. And the one of the buildings which won the Australian award, Forbes, Mastera, had lovely open spaces with trees going up five levels in the building. So it was just a lovely space to be in. Breezes went through the apartments. So all the architects are empowered and driven by sustainability in this country.
Well, coming from Vietnam, again, the issues we all know, you know, as developing countries, the people have always been kind of worried more about what's in their tummy and rather than what's good for the planet at the moment, you know. But all of that is changing, and with the benefit of different developers coming into the country. So I'll name three, you know. Gemuda Lam, when they came to Vietnam from Malaysia, they planted 10,000 trees at Celadon City, you know, and that's the first impact. You know, that alone reduces, you know, the kind of heat that's absorbed by the area, you know, and of course they then completed their huge development. They're more of a township, you know, and so all the issues that they brought to Vietnam, of course, they won the best green developer in 2017, and then a few developments thereafter. Another company I would quote is Capital Land, where they've won the best eco-friendly housing development. And then finally, you've got people like Capo Land. Again, these are the big names coming from Singapore, obviously. They did an amazing project called Infinity at Riviera Park in Ho Chi Minh City. And that was the best green development. So these, I mean, all the things that they brought, of course, Green Mark, and they brought to Vietnam. And I'm just waiting for the local developers who are now starting to catch on and kind of taking on these initiatives that have been brought to Vietnam from a more sophisticated developers from Malaysia and Singapore. Now kind of influencing the development in Vietnam today.
Now for our next question, what are some of the challenges associated with implementing sustainable architecture and how are they being addressed?
You know, I think there is a misconception that sustainable architecture or projects are very, very expensive and only reserved for the elite, you know. I sit on the board of director of the Vietnam Green Building Council, which basically developed LOTUS, which is a green rating tool for Vietnam. And this is one of the things that we try to do to create awareness, you know, that it doesn't cost that much more because, you know, if the sensibilities of passive design and just reusing materials is a huge benefit for your project. And of course, the issue we have in Vietnam is, of course, the government at the moment is not so, they haven't implemented all the sustainable requirements that you would have in other countries at the moment. But of course, that will change. You know? But in the meantime, the developers and architects, they do try to create sustainability using, again, I'm just going to go back to this passive design, you know, as a very, very simple way to create sustainable projects.
I completely agree with what Tien mentioned. There is, the misconception that sustainable architecture is inherently more expensive. I think in many countries around the region, we are also lacking public awareness of the importance and the benefits of sustainable architecture. In some countries, people are more preoccupied with making a living than having sustainable housing. But I think ultimately it's about sustainability being promoted by the government. And here I must echo one of my fellow judges, Joel Chen, who is the head of sustainability at Lendlease, who said, you know, enough of the carrot, time for the stick. And we've seen that in Europe, that sustainability in the built environment really got headway when the government put into place regulations and standards and rule. This is how it's going to be. No discussions about it. And unfortunately, it seems that this willingness of governments to take that stand is the biggest challenge for sustainability in the built environment today.
I mean, if I just jump in there for a second, I mean, construction basically is a huge greenhouse emitter. So it's something that when we build, the materials we use all produce greenhouse gases. And so I think I made a note earlier, 60% of our greenhouse gases are construction in Australia. It's quite a large number for the amount of construction we do. So materials now in our French office, basically the government has set rules, as Kristen said, that you cannot source materials unless they are carbon neutral. So the factories that produce these materials have to actually have zero carbon footprints. And that's the way the world is turning to. So I think as the generations go on, I mean, I've been in architecture for over 30 years now. So when I first started, yeah, passive design was all we really focused on, really, in those days. And orientation of buildings, cross flows, sun protection, all those things. And then CAD came into where we could control how the sun paths are looked at. So that was where we were. And then we went into like how are buildings insulated, how are they protected? And then the technology of how we can actually use better materials. So it's an evolving process. And Vietnam is a classic example. So maybe it's not at that step where it's regulated, but the drive from the architects and how they work through that system where it is now is where it is now. But it is changing all the way through. It changes by our next generation of graduates that come out who are driven in a different way than maybe I was when I graduated from university. So they see the world differently. So even with regulation, not with regulation, our skill sets and our sentiment and our driven forces as designers for a better world is just happening. It's just the technology is improving as well with that. And regulation comes into force. And I agree with Kristen, the fact that governments now in Australia, we are doing each time the building code comes out, it's more onerous on developers. So we have to follow those roads. So I always think we're about 2 to 5 years behind Europe in that type of thing. But we are learning quickly and we just evolve and become better at what we do. And developers they just accept that because they're evolving as well. So it's not that you might get some pushback, but most of the time they just accept it because that's the way the world's moving to.
Now, speaking of developers, along with the architects, how do you think they balance the need for sustainability with the need for profitability in the real estate industry?
Oh, if I can continue, because I said,
go on.
I was just going to continue that thing there. I said, in the early days, there was this pushback in, say, return on investment. Like a lot of the technologies had high costs. Like you put PV cells on a roof or use different materials, there was a high return over that time. Now we're finding that those return times are down to almost nothing now. They're cost neutral almost now. So those excuses are basically going. I mean, the push now is not for the return, it's actually providing the better space that the developers want. They want to have a point of difference for their developments that people want to go to. And like there's the new code which we're looking at the moment in Australia called the full living certification, where everything you do in a building has to give back. You can't have 95%, you have to have 120% return on water, 100%. So you have to give water back to the councils, you have to give electricity back to the grid, you have to actually make buildings which actually, whatever materials you use, have a benefit to the community. So developers, it's you will get some holding back because they want the return quickly, but they still want this point of difference to sell their product. And that's where the market's moving to.
It's at the end of the day, it does come down to profit, right? And for example, Vietnam, the people, the buyers and the people who want to rent, you know, the consumers, they're not so interested in saving the planet, you know, at the moment, you know. So that's it creates a huge challenge, you know, for developers to have this incentive. And if the government is not there to push them, again, very difficult. So, you know, that's why I'm very happy to see the kind of Singaporean and the Malaysian developers here who's leading the charge in this field. Because in Vietnam, not many people care at the moment, you know. But in Vietnam, all of our, if I mention Lotus and Vietnam Green Building Council, most of our kind of sustainable projects are industrial based, because big corporations, they can see the huge energy savings right away. In the condominiums, the residential, not so much so. But recently, Edge, you know, funded by the World Bank, you know, the IFC also has come in and have basically really helped to simplify the process of getting credits for sustainability. And I've noticed that a lot of our, even the local developers, they're jumping on and they're taking Edge on board. For me, I like the way Gamuda is moving, where it, you know, you're talking about the word biophilic, you know, Edge more to do with carbon footprint, but biophilia is more about health. You know, some of the, I always make a joke about how, you know, you see these amazing buildings which got like platinum LEED, right? But there's not a single tree on site, you know? And so sometimes there's a lot to be said for, you know, just some green in your building, this whole kind of well-being, you know, living with some kind of connection to nature.
Yeah, I think most has been said, yeah. Profitability, big take on this point. I think in the end, it's about adopting a long-term strategy and consider the life cycle cost of the building rather than just the upfront investment. So architects and developers can create a long-term strategy by incorporating sustainability at every stage of the construction process, from design to operation. And if you take all of that into account, where developers have incorporated energy efficiency and cost-saving measures, I think that soon and perhaps already, the incremental cost is not so high. And then, as Qian mentioned, it's also about educating the public about the benefits of a sustainable architecture and biophilia in the built environment.
Mm. What are some of the potential benefits for residents and occupants of sustainable buildings across the region?
Yes, Go on. I think, since we've just you know, touched up on it, you know, a LEED certified building that is just steel and concrete, you know, it's about improved occupant health and well-being. Green buildings have been found that to have positive impact on the occupiers, and studies indicate that people working in green buildings are less likely to experience fatigue, headaches, skin irritations, and things like that. And not only that, green buildings increase productivity and job satisfaction because the air quality is better. There is access to natural light, and then biophilic design elements have been linked to increased focus and creativity. And then obviously the cost savings, which, you know, the discussion tends to go through every time. By integrating those elements and passive design, you can lead to considerable cost savings.
Ian?
Yeah, I think the just to add on to what Kristen just mentioned, you know, there's just the things about, you know, just improved indoor air quality, you know, just some thermal comfort, access to natural light. You know, people have really experienced that with the whole COVID lockdowns, you know, and so they really, that just hit home, you know. You just look around, are you happy with your indoor space, you know, and so sustainability is not just about saving the planet, but it's about your health, you know. So I think that's the benefit that we all as, you know, designers, developers, people in the property market, we need to kind of push this to create this kind of awareness for the consumers so that they understand that it's more than just about some kind of saving our grandchildren for the future, but, you know, it's our own, you know, pleasing living environment today.
And finally, Louis?
I agree with most my esteemed colleagues here. I mean, the other thing that, from what we had at the awards last year, was one of the main buildings which won awards in Australia and some of the gala awards was from Queensland, which had a big push for a building which catered for not only just environmental and better building within the space or conditions, it also created a space where people could actually work in the building because of COVID. They made such a big effort to have a whole floor of an apartment building. So during COVID, people could actually work part-time at home. They also try to create amenities within the building that people could sort of eat and work and be there, as well as being right on a travel nexus as well. And that's what we have to learn from our northern neighbours, which they do so well, is build on a travel network, which in Australia, we still haven't got that down pat. We still think of cars, but if you go to Bangkok, you go to Singapore, you go to Vietnam, there's the buildings have got nexuses on great rapid transit systems, infrastructure, incorporating not only residential buildings, but health, education, also you don't have to travel as much as well. So that also adds to the environmental sustainability effect of that building, of that design. So you're actually lowering the footprint of the building because you're getting more facilities in a smaller area. And yeah, I mean, we're in Australia, we have a lot of land and whatever. We have to learn how to be better at that. So that's where we learn from the northern neighbors. So, and that's why maybe the knock-on effect of all these, of the property guru and what they do is, it's the sharing of all this intelligence. So designers and developers from Australia can interrogate designs from Singapore, from Vietnam, from Thailand, from China, and actually pick out what's best for our own markets as well. So it's great in that sense. So that's basically it.
I think it's just to add on, Louis, you know, this whole mixed-use development, as this coined phrase, you know, in the recent decade, has always been the case in Asia. You know, in North America, which was kind of a big influence in the 1960s, where, you know, they were segregating where this area is where you live, this area is where you work. And, you know, then that created all the problems of transport and all that sort of thing. Well, in Asia, all that hodgepodge of, you know, mixed use development, it was always here. You know, people walk to work. They walk to have a coffee and they ate near where they lived, you know, and so that it worked all along, you know, and so it now became this kind of mixed use development, but it was always here, which is the interesting thing, right? It was always sustainable.
And a country like Australia, which developed a lot from the 50s onwards, because our population was so low and we have so few cities in a big country, it's like that. It is suburbia stretched out on the freeways. There was a downtown CBD where everyone worked and drove, and now that model has been turned upside down, and we're trying to repair all that now. And the big cities like Melbourne and Sydney have got that down pat, and the population has swarmed to the CBD, and that's what we want, because once that happens also, you create so much more amenity in the area and make a vibrant city. Whereas if I leave my office, and my house is only 900 meters, but a lot of people drive home to the house, and the CBD is very quiet because everyone's gone home. So it just, the whole environment is changing because of this thought of how to actually travel less, be more conservative how we live and all that as well. We don't need extravagant houses an hour and a half away from where we work, and that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Now, finally, how do you see sustainable architecture and evolving in Asia in the coming years? Who would like to go first?
Okay, and again, I always have to refer to our neighbors, you know, Singapore and Malaysia and to some extent in Australia. You know, there's a new phase now in Singapore. You know, forget about biophilia, it's not good enough now. It's now biodiversity, you know, which is a very interesting thing, where you basically, in landscaping terms, you're not just looking at planting and you're not just looking at carbon footprint, you know, but you're looking at trying to create environments where you attract the birds again, attracting the butterflies, you know, and all the things that we used to live with. But then when we built our cities, we start push them all out because, you know, so I think I love that new kind of move towards, biodiversity. And I think that's where it should be. Again, in Vietnam, we have a long way to go. But with this recent kind of move where Vietnam is developing a lot of its hospitality resorts environments, the architects and developers are starting to notice. And so if all of Asia is moving, and I believe it is, as this coming few in our lifetime, you know, much more growth than North America or Europe, right? So I think I have a great confidence that we will, in the next, say, 10, 20 years, we'll be fronting the whole kind of sustainable developments of our environments.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, because what we just discussed about Asian cities being inherently mixed because people live and work together in the same area. We are seeing the depth of many North American cities because people are working from home and nobody's coming back to the city centers. And I think that because of the way that many Asian cities are developed, at least there's one thing that is out of the way, that is less of a headache. I mean, for the ones of us who are in Southeast Asia, it's been horribly hot in the last couple of weeks. In Singapore, we had the hottest day for the last 40 years. So the urgency is there. In Asia, we have got a lot of the sustainable materials like bamboo and techniques of passive design and natural airflow. So all the elements are there. What is needed for it to go even faster is the government intervention. Yeah, it's not a popular topic, but at some point, taxation and standards and regulation must become more onerous for developers to act.
I agree with everything that was just said in there. So I'm so optimistic of how we are progressing as a sustainable sort of group, and Asia in some parts are a little bit behind, some parts are a bit ahead, but I think the countries which are a little bit behind will learn very quickly to move forward from learning from their neighbors. And I think the lessons that we are learning south are very important, how we work with that as well. And I think that what Kristen said about cities dying, cities like Melbourne through the lockdowns, it was like a ghost town because everyone was working from home and it was killing businesses. So that has to change. And I just heard that one of our big banks has just mandated that everyone has to go back to the office now. You can't work from home anymore because the impact of all that has been detrimental to the environment, to the economy, I should say. So that's one thing. So we have to move past that. So the only thing I can add to this is, together as a body together, we are learning that we are a bit better sustainable, but also I think the designs of the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, maybe when I'm watching other great young architects and designers and developers, buildings will give back so much to the environment. It won't just be given a little bit, they will be given back a lot more. And that's what we'll be aiming for. So everything be positive, nothing negative. So concretes, materials, we'll all be adding to the environment. We'll be sucking carbon dioxide out of the air and using our buildings to absorb that. We'll be planting more trees, more landscaping to provide environments that people want to live in those spaces. Buildings will have more natural materials, and technology will move forward in the sense that when the design life of a building may finish, we may just take part of the skin off, put a new skin on, which has been recycled, and we don't have to actually put a facade on. It might just be part of a facade on a building. So it's just taken that next step forward. So I just keep thinking 5, 10 years, 20 years, there will be plus in all these things, in all those cities throughout Asia too. I think it'll all grow.
I think just to add to that, you know, sustainability is not just about buildings. I think what we're talking about here is that it's also about social living, community, sustainable living environments is what we're talking about, right? So, you know, it's as soon as people realize that, you know, why do they not want to go back to work at this big bank? It's because it's so far away, you know. Exactly. They lose an hour, sometimes 2 hours.
Yeah,
you know, all of their life sitting in these cars, polluting the environment, you know. So as soon as developers, architects, the government, you know, understand this, you know, that these mixed use developments and trying to create communities and environments which are, you know, better for us socially, you know, then I think we've that's half the battle in terms of sustainability.
And if I could just pick another example from my state, my city, because we have a large freeway system that goes miles and miles and miles up and down the beach. People who buy a cheap block of land an hour and a half away don't realize the cost to get the infrastructure out to that very cheap property, of all the roads, the electricity, all that infrastructure to give them a cheap piece of land. With that land, that money could be used better to consolidate where we are and actually get the cities. And like I said, we're a city of 2 million people, 2.5 million people. I'd love it to be 5-10 million people, massive sort of like building where everyone sort of like is in that city, so we can actually use the facilities instead of just leave them half empty and have the great parks and whatever, which people don't use.
Well, we have a lot to learn here in Manila. I mean, the country's just way behind. But once again, thank you for your insights, most especially for your time. Again, we have Ms. Kristin Thornston, Head of Partnerships Growth for APAC, IWG, PLC, and Chairperson of Singapore. We have Sir Louis Violante, Regional Manager, Western Australia, Inhabit Group, and Chairperson of Australia. And lastly, Mr. Tien Duong, General Director, Group GSA Vietnam and Chairperson of Vietnam. Thanks for tuning in to the first episode for 2023 of the Property Report podcast by Property Guru. We have exciting topics lined up, so please stay tuned for our next coming episodes. This has been Tina Ryan, and for more information, kindly visit asiapropertyawards.com. Thank you once again.